All right, folks, welcome back to the Game Trail Podcast. It's going to be a solo episode. I know that last time I indicated that I have a guest. Guest kind of fell through. She's busy. People are out hunting and totally understand. Had an opportunity that popped up and just missed out. So back with a solo episode. I'm going to dive into it here pretty quick. But one of the questions that I get asked quite a bit is like, oh, do you ever eat tags? And it's had me thinking. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about tags that I've eaten over the years, which as I made the list and thinking about this episode, it's been a fair number of tags that I've eaten for a variety of reasons. And I think it's probably interesting. And I don't know if it's interesting to you, but it'd be interesting to me to kind of go back and relive some of these hunts and think about them and maybe do a bit of a deep dive on why I was unsuccessful. Hopefully that can help me out in the future to be able to fill more permits. I think people maybe get the idea that it's always automatic, and it's definitely not. You know, over the years I've eaten a fair number of permits. I thought it might be kind of fun. It might help me learn. Hopefully it can help you guys pick up a tip or two on why some hunts are more successful than others. So that's kind of my plan for the day. I don't really have a lot of notes for this podcast. Basically I just went through and made a list of the permits that I've eaten, in more recent memory. There's probably some in the past that I've eaten, but, basically really non-scripted. I just want to kind of talk off the cuff, maybe relive some of these hunts, some of the more interesting moments, some of the factors on why, a hunt really didn't come together. It's always interesting too, when you go back and relive some of these. As I was thinking about doing this podcast, you know, how your memory changes, or I always wonder like, what's the truth? The reason that I say that is because, I was talking to my brother-in-law this last weekend, and there's a funny story that he and I shared together. It wasn't on a hunt, completely unrelated, but, we were talking about it and he kind of retold the story. And as I went back through in my mind, I'm like, oh, it's not exactly how I remember it. So you always remember things differently than maybe somebody else that was there. And I think is over time, fades. I think you kind of maybe, I don't know, remember things differently. It's interesting. Something to think about anyway, but, getting off on a tangent, but, I guess before I get started, I'm going to hit you guys with a promo. So you can use the promo code GAMETRAIL. You can use that when you sign up for Go Hunt Insider account, and you're going to get $50 back in the Go Hunt gear shop, which you can use towards the purchase of any gear that you want in the shop. Now's a great time as we move into Black Friday sales coming up to, you know, get yourself an insider membership, and, you know, you can apply those points, those $50 towards the purchase of some gear that's probably on sale. Maybe you've identified some holes in your equipment as the season has progressed, and, you know, you want to pick up a few things when they're on sale. So use that promo code GAMETRAIL when you sign up. Also, shout out to Matthews as the sponsor of the podcast. I don't know when this goes out, if the new bows will be live or not. I think that they probably will, but I think you guys will be stoked to check those out. I know that's one of my very favorite things every single year, is just to see the new options that are out there and kind of get to play with them and test them and shoot them. And, you know, I love it. I love this time of year. I've had my eyes on this new Hamsky R7 rest. It just barely came out. I've had Hamskys over the years. They continually are striving to make improvements, and this R7 looks really, really sleek and interesting to me. For a lot of years, I always shot limb-driven rests. There is, I think, in my opinion, maybe a bit of a downfall in that arrow is, you know, not on the actual prong, or, you know, the rest part of it until you come to full draw. So you've got to contain that arrow, keep it from moving. When you're in a stocking situation, they've got those little rest arrow holders, which are handy. But over the years, I have appreciated a rest like the QAD, which essentially keeps your arrow contained until, you know, you're ready to draw back and shoot. But that new R7 definitely looks interesting. I was talking to our new archery guy in the office last week. His name's Cody Frick. By the way, if you guys aren't aware, we do have a full pro shop coming. We'll really kick it off in 2026, but he's ordering bows. We're going to have bows there in the shop. That guy's a great technician. He can get you set up with a new bow. But yeah, talking to Cody about all the different bows and just what's coming out there. And then also about ATA, which is coming up in January. I think I'm going to get an opportunity to go to ATA this year. It's been a couple of years since I've been, but I love that show. It's one of my favorite shows, is just go kick around as a real archery nerd. It's fun to look at all the new equipment, new arrows, new rests, all the gadgetry, broadheads. It's a fun show to go to. And then this year where they've added the shoot on the back end of that, and then also making it a consumer show the last day or maybe even 2 days where consumers can show up and actually purchase equipment. It might bring a new look to that show, kind of a new feel, a new vibe. And I think it'll be fun to go to. And then I'm hoping to get an indoor bow, you know, kind of set up and give that another run. You know, as you were moving into those colder months, I'm definitely looking at shooting more indoor. And, you know, Vegas last year, I shot it, didn't have a great showing by any means, didn't live up to what my expectations were for myself, but I would like to do it again. I would like to improve upon last year. I do think that shooting indoor, whether it's your local league at a shop or, you know, even with your buddies getting together and just shooting paper three spots, I think it's a great way to improve your shot and your shot execution, your focus. One thing Vegas last year definitely highlighted for me was that I lacked some mental focus when in that type of environment. And I think that translates over into a hunting situation. So I want to do more of it. And if I can get an indoor bow set up and dialed, then I can make it to ATA and I can shoot that Rushmore Rumble, I believe was what they're calling it. They're transferring it over there to the ATA show, which is going to be in Indianapolis this year. I think I'd like to shoot it and continue to just kind of add, you know, a different perspective and put some more pressure on myself and, you know, hopefully improve, right, when the moment counts. So that'll be fun. But yeah, I love this time of year. It's always fun to see the new equipment. I think you guys will be stoked with the new Matthew stuff that's coming out. So with that, let's dive in. I made a list of tags that I've eaten over the years. So I'm going to run through them. Most recently, a Wyoming general season elk tag, ate that. New Zealand tar, which I think you guys kind of got to see a glimpse into. We're going to do a hunt film on that. I ate that tag. Alaska black bear also wasn't this last May. I think it was the May before. Ate that tag for a similar reason that I ate the tag in New Zealand. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Arizona late season archery elk. I'm getting ready to leave tomorrow, actually, on a late season archery elk hunt in Arizona in a unit that I've hunted before. I've previously hunted 3 late archery elk seasons in Arizona, and out of the 3, I've ate 2 of the tags. So I killed a really nice bull the first year. The second 2 times that I've hunted those hunts, I ate those tags. So those are tough hunts, but ate the tag. Colorado, our over-the-counter archery elk. We did a film with Neville and I where we went in together. We hunted, and Neville killed a bull, I think, on the, I want to say, the 2nd or 3rd evening. We spent a day, maybe a day and a half packing that out. We hunted the rest of the time. I think we hunted a total of maybe 7 or 8 days, and I ended up eating that tag. New Mexico archery elk, also with Neville. You know, he and I both drew tags. We got Neville a bull killed, but I ultimately ended up eating my tag for that hunt. And then Arizona archery antelope, ate an archery antelope permit in Arizona. And if you guys know how hard it is to draw an archery antelope tag or any antelope tag in the state of Arizona, you know that one stung particularly. But I ate that permit, and we also did a film about that. But I've eaten some permits over the years, and it's had me, you know, thinking about it. So I'm going to run through those. So most recently, Wyoming general season elk tag. So we went in as a group. Originally the idea was that, Omar, Lorenzo, Chris Porter, and I, we all work here at Go Hunt, that we were going to do a hunt there. We combine our points. We would go in as a group application and we would draw. Now, Porter and I had enough points that we could have drawn the Western region, which is a region that I've hunted before. It's a region I feel really confident in. I've always filled my permits in that area, those units that are encompassed within that Western region. We had the points to draw that. We decided ultimately to go to the southern region. It's a region that I had wanted to hunt. I'd kind of had my eye on it. I just thought it'd be a fun change of pace, hunt a different area with some different country. And then Lorenzo and Omar didn't have quite the points that they needed to get the western region. And so we decided to go to that southern region. We went up and we left. Omar and I went a little bit early. I think we left the 12th, I believe, of September. High hopes going into that hunt. You know, I'd done a bunch of talking. I felt like I'd done a due diligence as far as kind of picking out some areas that I thought looked elky. They looked good. Omar and I got up there 2 days before Chris and Lorenzo showed up in hopes of having found elk and having the opportunity to get into bulls and get a bugle in and hopefully maybe even fill a permit or two prior to those guys getting there so that we could try to fill all four permits. And we've done podcasts about it. You know, I know we talked about it a little bit, but basically we went 0-for-4. And that's an interesting hunt for me. It's one that is a real stinger, to be honest. Like, that one really bites. I think it was ultimately a combination of maybe not having honed my skills, especially in the calling department, maybe. It's hard to say, but those general season elk hunts, I've had success in those types of areas, having not been what I would say a good caller. I don't think I'm a terrible caller, but I don't think I'm a great caller by any stretch of the imagination. And I haven't really pushed the envelope. I'm trying to get better. Just being completely frank, I don't practice a ton. It's not something that, like, during the summer I was putting a lot of time and effort into, you know, blowing a bugle or working on my cow calls or anything like that. And I think looking back on it, it might have really finally come back to full fruition and bit me in the butt. In the past, general season elk hunts, I felt like I've been able to utilize the skills that I think that I am good at. Things like, you know, physicality, being able to hike, live off my back, cover ground, you know, put space between myself and other people to find elk that were maybe less pressured. And because of that, I think maybe, you know, my lackluster calling skills ultimately helped me, you know, it because those elk weren't as pressured, right? Now moving into Wyoming general season, in the area that we hunted, this area had a lot of roads, a lot of trails. It didn't really ever feel like I could get too far from other people. We were constantly seeing people. I remember one day in particular, probably the best day of rut activity that we had. We got onto a couple bugling bulls in the morning. This was the 20th, which if you guys go back and look at the moon phase and kind of look at the rut calendar and their predictions that people had for the rut, myself included, we really thought that 20th was going to be the very best day. I thought it was going to be the best day of rut activity ever in the history of ever. But we got onto a couple of bulls in the morning and we followed them off into a drainage. And then up the other side, we were trailing this herds and we ended up popping up over a little ridge, and as we did, we saw a bull and two cows coming right towards us. It looked like they'd maybe either been pushed off by another bull or potentially even spooked by another hunter, which is what I think happened based on, you know, kind of the rest of the story. But these two cows and the bull coming right towards us, and I told Chris, I said, hey, if they come below us, it's going to be dicey because the wind was kind of blowing down from us to them. I said, if they come above us, I think we're golden. We'll have the wind and I think we'll get a great shot. Ultimately, they ended up going below us. They caught our wind and buggered off. We got on the other bull and we trailed him. And that's when we run into a couple other guys that come in from the top that were calling. And that bull went up and over the top and disappeared. And we kind of lost him. Didn't hear any more bugles. And then in the afternoon, we decided it's time to restock our gear, mostly food, but we ended up going out the bottom. We got a bull going in the middle of the day, probably noon. He was really fired up right on a creek. To me, it looked like he'd probably left some cows up on the mountain and dipped down to the creek in the afternoon for a drink and then was working back up. We got him bugling. And as we worked up in underneath him, you know, we were calling to him. I could see him on the ridge. He was maybe 110 yards and it got another bull. excited. He started piping off and he started coming in, kind of closing the distance, which is ultimately like the best case scenario, is to get between two bugle and bulls. So I was calling, he was calling. He came into about 45 yards. He had one tree to clear and didn't end up making that final, you know, fatal decision to like step out broadside, and he reversed. As I've looked back on that, I just don't know that my calling was good enough. I just don't know that I was believable enough. And this goes both ways. I hear people say that, you know, an elk is an elk. Like he's no difference from like a moo cow, right? He doesn't know the difference between a hunter and, you know, other elk. I don't think that I believe that. I think that they can probably tell the difference between a hunter with a lackluster bugle or a cow call, like I probably have, and another elk. I think they can tell the difference. And I think in that situation, particularly, I've been, you know, reliving the moment in my mind. I think it was probably, you know, I just wasn't good enough. Like I just didn't have the calls in my bag of tricks to be able to like lure him in those last, you know, maybe 5 yards or 10 yards. I didn't have the calling skills. I didn't know what calls to make exactly in the right tone to get that other bull to come down to me. You know, in that day we ended up seeing, and this is where I originally started this part of the story, but you know, we had the hunters that came in over the top that were calling as we were sitting there on that hillside after that situation had kind of fizzled out. We had two guys come down the ridge that were out hunting, and then probably an hour later we had two other guys come up from the bottom that walked right past us. And it's not like we were right next to the road. We were probably 2 miles deep, 2.5 maybe. But there were people in there, and there were pressure. There were people calling all over the place. I remember talking to one guy that said, man, we've heard a lot of bugles. We've heard tons and tons of elk calling. And, you know, as I was thinking through it, I thought, you know, maybe I've heard one or two that I thought were bulls, and everybody else I thought was hunters. So, it just goes to show you that the quality of your calling and your ability to call elk, I think it makes a difference. And if I look back on it, I think that's been a real hole in my game. It's been one that I've been unwilling, if you will, to work at, just because I've been able to utilize other skills, whether it's patience and, you know, days in the field or persistence in being able to get out away from other people and hunt unpressured elk. I also learned in that hunt that, actually there's two things I would say. One, I definitely need to upgrade or improve my calling ability. And, the other thing I would say is I need to pick units or pick areas that are more conducive to my skill set. That time of year when we were hunting, and in the area we were hunting, I couldn't really utilize the skills that I think that I have an advantage, which, like I've already said, is kind of that physicality, my ability to move away from other people, my ability to glass. Like I'm a pretty good glasser, pretty decent spot and stalk style elk hunter, if you will. And that area was not conducive to it. You couldn't really glass that much. Also early season, I'm really patient. I've had good success over hunting wallows, and they weren't really hitting wallows later in the rut. So I was there from like the 12th to maybe the 25th in that time frame. I wasn't really finding wallows that were getting hit. I think if you hunt maybe that first week of September, I did definitely find some wallows that I think would have been great, but they just weren't hitting them that time frame of the hunt. So I think if I'd have hunted earlier, you know, I probably would have been able to use that skill set that I've got to my advantage. So that's definitely lessons learned. I think all lending itself to me not filling a permit, and then just admitting that, you know, I'm not a great elk caller, and it's something that I've got to improve. I've done a lot of thinking about why. It's interesting, like, you know, the things that you're not good at or the things that you kind of struggle with, you kind of gravitate away from. Like, oh, I don't want to do that because I don't think I'm that good at it. But the only way to get good at it is to like work at it and practice. And that's like one of those things that I'm going to have to physically make myself do if I want to be more successful. And it's stupid because I love hunting elk, and kind of the essence of archery elk hunting is calling, right? But I think I've been lucky, I would say. I've been lucky in that I've hunted areas that you know, they were less call shy, you know, areas that are, you know, limited draw permits. So Colorado last year when I went, I burned, I want to say 8 or 9 points on a unit that didn't have a ton of permits in it. And those elk were definitely way less call shy. But if I'm going to have success on general season type elk tags, tags that are easy to get, you know, I'm talking the Idaho, OTC, which, like I said, it's a draw that's coming up here pretty quick, by the way. But, you know, OTC type permits, permits that are relatively easy to get, general season permits where residents can hunt and you get a lot of pressure, I'm definitely going to have to button up that portion of my game. Even since I got home, I've been listening to a lot of elk calling, just watching YouTube videos. And that's all things that I should have been doing prior to leaving. It's funny. I've been doing this for, well, I don't know, a lot of years, and I've had decent success, I would say, on archery elk hunts, but, man, I'm just constantly relearning, like having to relearn things that I thought I already knew. I know I need to be an elk caller. I know I need to be a better elk caller, but I've put that off. And, you know, I think if anything, if you're unsuccessful, it sucks. It hurts because you want to be successful. That's the reason you're out there, right? You're taking days away from home and your job and everything else that's going on in your life to be out there. Ultimately, you want to be successful. And there's really nothing like being unsuccessful to light a real fire under your ass to get you going again. So, if anything, it is good for that. But that was kind of my thought process behind that Wyoming general season elk tag. You know, picking areas, becoming a better elk caller, and, you know, trying to really button that up. New Zealand tar. So if you guys followed along with that whole episode, that was a real butt kicker. That was the most physical hunt I think I've ever been on. You know, when we landed in New Zealand, we met our friends from down there, Monty and Cam. Those guys were top notch, just such cool guys. Really kind to offer us the time and show us, you know, kind of their way of hunting. The first 2.5 days, so it took us 2.5 days of backpacking just to get into the area where we would actually be hunting tar, which was way more than I expected. It was also some of the most technical, steep, nasty, treacherous terrain that I've ever hunted. I remember walking up to the first river crossing and, you know, I thought we'd be wet, right? Like I thought we'd be, you know, crossing creeks, not a big deal. You know, you're used to Western big game hunting. You're going to end up crossing some creeks and some rivers. But we walked up with this first one and I looked over and I saw Monty going out ahead of us. And, you know, he's up to the bottom of his backpack. Like he's waist deep walking and, you know, no big deal. He's just like going for it. I thought, oh, okay, this is a different beast. So we got up into Alpine, finally ended up getting a decent weather day. We made a great big trek to the very tip top of the mountain. Monty put together a perfect game plan. We came in along the top of this ridge, crept down, ended up seeing a big billy, you know, got close to him. He ended up kind of avoiding us and going a different direction than what we thought. And then, you know, I ended up kind of creeping further down and we ended up spotting these two bulls that were bedded on this little bench. And the lay of the topography allowed us to sneak down this little ravine, pop up onto this little knoll. And as we popped up on top, we were about 45, 50 yards from them. And, you know, we ended up having to wait them out because they were bedded. In the meantime, we had a couple other young bulls that came up underneath us and ended up kind of bumping. Not so hard that the two bigger bulls cleared country. They kind of stayed in there. And then, you know, they kind of relaxed, bed back down. We were just waiting them out. I think we were probably there for probably 35 or 40 minutes. And then those two younger bulls ended up coming back. And at this time, it got the other two bigger bulls up off their feet. And the bigger bull at one point was broadside, pretty much broad, totally broadside at 40 yards, which is a shot I felt really comfortable in. And it was a shot that I wanted to take. And I'd ranged him, had a good range on him. And I started to draw my bow back. And as I started to draw my bow back, I heard Monty, who's, you know, our New Zealander buddy, he's up the hill, you know, he whispers, he said, no, let's wait. And, you know, to his, you know, he made a good decision in all honesty. Like, it's always best to get the closest shot that you can when you're bow hunting. I don't fault him at all for saying no. But that was a shot that I felt good about. I felt in the moment like that's the shot that I wanted and I wanted to take. And what ended up happening, the reason I wanted to take it was because the two smaller bulls were kind of working our way and they were out ahead of the two bigger bulls. And as they started to work towards us, I figured that there was going to be a point where those two younger bulls were going to clear our line of sight. They were going to be able to see us. And at that point, like, I figured that the situation was going to escalate. It was going to heighten because they were going to become aware of our presence. You know, it's going to put them and the two bigger bulls on edge, which is what I was worried about. And that's ultimately what kind of ended up happening is, you know, the two younger bulls fed up underneath us and ended up seeing us, and they kind of bumped a little bit. And the bigger bull was pretty well unaware of our presence at that time, but the two younger ones kind of buggered a little bit. And at that point, Monty whispered 30, 30, you know, like he'd ranged the bigger bull, and the bigger bull was down on kind of his knees, basically feeding. And I drew back and executed shot. And I ended up hitting him high on the entrance, the exit, and we've got it on video. It'll be interesting to actually be able to look at it on the big screen when the full video comes out. But the exit to me looked good. I've looked at the stills of the arrow that it's hanging out of his offside so many times. I'm sick of looking at it. You know, but he jumped, took off running, ended up piling over into a kind of a group of canyons. So there's a bunch of different canyons, maybe two or three that kind of run down to the bottom, and it got progressively thicker and, you know, the vegetation got taller and higher. And at the shot, I felt good about it. And I figured that I was going to be able to find this bull tar, which I was really excited about because he was just a great tar, one of the better bulls that we'd seen the whole hunt. Anyway, we gave it probably 15 or 20 minutes, ended up wandering down, didn't find any blood, ended up kind of working the direction that he went, and ended up finding my arrow, which the arrow was blood end to end, but absolutely no blood on the ground whatsoever. And then to make a long story short, we ended up gritting out the top ends of those canyons all day long, just looking for any kind of sign of blood, looking for tar. Did not end up finding any blood, no blood whatsoever, and no tar. So I came home, you know, having eaten that tag. Didn't go out again, didn't attempt any other opportunities or stalks. Part of that was because of the weather, but then I also just didn't know. It might be interesting to talk at this point about wounding animals, because some of these I'm going to talk about are wounded animals that I lost, and, you know, that being the reason that I was unsuccessful. Kind of my take on wounding is, if I think I killed the animal, if I think the animal is mortally wounded, like it's going to die, and I didn't find it. So if it was like a gut shot, or even if I don't really know, like if I don't have enough information to go on, I think it may have been mortally wounded. I'm going to eat my tag. And that's just kind of how I feel. If I feel like the animal is not mortally wounded, if it's good to go, if I end up seeing it again, I feel better about continuing to hunt. That's kind of my take on it. But this one was just like a heartbreaker. This is probably the one that bothers me the most of, you know, all the bow hunts that I've gone on. I've wounded a few animals, not a ton, but I've wounded a few, and they've all been recently, probably within the last 2-3 years, I would say, which I'm becoming more comfortable, I guess, in talking about as time passes. And I can dive into why. Part of it is just because I don't want bow hunting to be perceived in a bad light. Part of it is also, it just stings and I hate reliving it. Just being completely candid, it's just not fun memories. I think it's probably important to talk about because I know that it happens, but it's just not fun. It's not comfortable. And I definitely don't want bow hunting to be perceived in a bad light, because it's a sport that I want to persist, and I want people to have the opportunity to go out and bow hunt, myself included. It's something that like I highly value, and I love the sport of archery and, you know, the tradition of it. But when I think back on that hunt, there's a couple of take homes for me. One of them being, moving forward, I want the decision making to be my own. And like I said, I don't fault Monty at all. I think he made the right call. I think the call to wait for it to get closer was the right call. In saying that, I think every bow hunter, they have to take accountability. And I didn't make the best shot. If I'd have been, you know, 6 inches lower, 5 inches lower, it would have been, you know, a dead bull tar, and I'd have found it no problem. So the responsibility of making the shot lies solely upon me. But maybe not, but maybe, and maybe is the word I should use, but, and looking at it, I just want the decision-making to be mine. The shot that I really wanted was the 40-yard shot. I felt confident in the shot. I felt good about the reasoning behind taking that shot then, being that the animals were at ease. They had no, they just didn't know we were there. I mean, they were completely unaware that we were even in the neighborhood, which is always the best situation. When an animal is completely unaware, there's no, you know, reason for them to jump a string or, you know, to bolt earlier. And I think anytime that an animal becomes aware of you, it just heightens the situation. It makes you more prone to rushing things, you know, making decisions that you wouldn't make when the animal is more relaxed. It just heightens the entire situation, shoots that shot of adrenaline. Like, you just know that the situation is about to blow up, and it's not a good, it's just not a good situation. Sometimes you can't avoid it. It just is what it is when in hunting. But ideally for me, I want it to be, you know, under my own direction. I want to be able to pick the spot, pick the shot, and I want those reasons and those responsibilities to lie solely upon me. So looking back on it, I wish I would have taken the 40-yard shot. I wish I'd have gone with my gut. I wished I would have, you know, drawn back. I had the perfect range. I'd ranged it from my location, so I had the range. And I wish I would have executed that shot. It's just a lesson for me going forward that, you know, as a hunter, I think the responsibility lies upon us. And, you know, as you gain experience in hunting, you kind of learn to develop and process the situation. And I think you probably, you know, you probably know when is the right time. And I think for me, that was the right time. And, I wished I'd have just taken it, but is what it is. Like I said, it's a lesson learned. It's something I've thought a lot about. I definitely do not fault anybody for what happened other than myself, because it was my responsibility to make what was, or should have been, just a chip shot, you know, 25, 30 yard shot. So, that's a lesson learned and a real punch in the gut. That's a hunt that I've been thinking about that I want to do again. Like, that's one that I feel like I got a bit of a chip on my shoulder, if you will. Like, I feel like I worked so hard for that opportunity. You know, I know in saying that, those guys are probably giggling if they listen to this, because they do that all the time. Those guys are tough on a level that I can't really comprehend. I mean, they do it all the time. But for me, I felt like I'd worked really hard to get into that shot situation. And it was an animal that I really, really wanted. The landscape was incredible, incredible adventure. And it was just something that I really wanted to see to fruition, but didn't work out. And, you know, it's bummed me out. Alaska black bear. So I went on a hunt to Alaska. It was a boat hunt. We took a boat out. I was invited by the guys at SIG. So I went with Troy Hellman, who's a good dude, good friend. I really liked that guy a lot. Crispy was there. But yeah, we were going to go out and hunt. And Steve from Born and Raised, good dude also. Some of my favorite guys, to be honest. Like, if I was to put together a crew of dudes that I enjoy hunting with, you know, those guys are all right there near the top of them. All of them really nice guys. I like those guys a lot. But Went out, wasn't the best bear hunting conditions. Pretty rainy. We weren't seeing a ton of bears. Ultimately I ended up deciding to, you know, hunt this big tidal flat, big grassy flat. As I got out there, I was just going to sit for the evening and hope that, a bear would feed out onto it and I would get an opportunity. The guys were going to pick me up later in the evening in the boat. As I sat there glassing across, I ended up seeing one bear, was trying to put together a plan. And then, you know, I looked further, kind of up into this little drainage and I saw this big boar feeding out. And, you know, he was a lot closer and he was in a real stalkable position. So ended up making a stalk, ended up crawling out across this big tidal flat. I had good cover on my hands and knees as I was crawling out towards him. As I got closer, I had another smaller bear that popped up between he and I. I think it was probably a sow. I was able to stay undetected, but it kind of limited my ability to get any closer to the big boar. I kind of waited for the smaller sow to clear. She kind of ended up feeding back towards the boar, but I just couldn't close the distance before what it looked like, you know, the bigger bear was going to actually feed out away from me. And I didn't think I'd be able to keep up. So I got to 55 yards, ended up ranging that boar, stepped out broadside. It was raining pretty hard. And ended up anchoring in and making a shot. Left to right, it was good, but ended up hitting low. And I ended up hitting him in the brisket. And I watched him go up behind a big tree, expecting fully for him to tip over and die right there. I could see him for probably 10 seconds, 15 seconds or so. And then I lost sight of him. I couldn't really figure it out because it looked to me like where he was at, he had a big cliff behind him. I didn't think he would be able to get out either left or right without me seeing him. And I never did end up seeing him go left or right. So I assumed that he was dead. So I gave it probably a half hour, ended up walking over there, found good blood, trailed it up the face kind of behind this big tree, right to the cliff face, and then ended up trailing, seeing blood going right up this vertical cliff face. In my years, would I have thought a big black bear boar that was hit with an arrow could scale that face. I didn't think he could probably scale it even if he hadn't been wounded, but he ended up going right up this big face. I couldn't believe it. It was bad enough that I couldn't actually go up it myself. I ended up having to work my way around the end and ended up getting up on top. And when I got up on top, it was so thick, hard to navigate. Like it took me probably an hour just to get up on top to where I could kind of start getting enough level ground that I could start to kind of pick my way around. I ended up looking for any sign of that bear for probably 6 to 8 hours, I would say. I ended up looking all day for that bear, any sign of that bear. Couldn't find any more blood. It did continue to rain the entire time. Ended up looking until it was absolutely, almost too dark for me to see. And it got to a point where if I'm going to get off this face safely, I got to go. So I ended up picking my way down and ended up meeting up with my camera guy who'd stayed down on the flat. Ended up meeting him. And again, it had been raining the entire day. And he and I ended up holing up beneath a tree, ended up meeting the boat, and pulled up the video that night and looked at the shot on a laptop. And I definitely hit that bear low, like low in the brisket. And sick to my stomach, right? It's that sinking feeling that you hit an animal and didn't find it. Wounding just absolutely sucks. I think it's one of the worst feelings ever. But that one really put me in a low spot. Decided not to hunt anymore. Tried to help the other guys do some glassing. Didn't put any more stalks. We didn't really see any other bears. Troy did end up shooting a bear. I think maybe it might have even been that day or the day prior, to be honest, with a rifle. He made a great shot and killed it. I don't think Chris even got a real good stalk on. It was just tough hunting conditions. Looking back on that hunt, lessons learned. I don't shoot that much in the rain, and I'm not saying that's solely the reason that I, hit low, but it definitely has kind of been playing in my mind. I had wondered originally if just having the bow completely wetted out. I have heard or read that your strings and your cables being completely soaked out, that you might lose some feet per second and that your impact might be low. I think I have disproven that theory. I don't think it was the string. I don't think it was the cables being wet. I do think in all the reading that I've done since, that your impact point in a downpour is going to be lower, but I think it's because of your veins cutting through that water and that rain. I think that's the issue. I think you just have more, you just have more surface area that's catching that rain and more drag, if you will, in those conditions. So I think that is a good reason, or it might be a reason that was low. You know, one of the other things that I was kind of kicking around, so I was using a Excel landslide site, as I was walking through the brush. And if you've ever been to Alaska, you guys probably know that the alder and the grass is just so tall. There's so much brush. As you're walking through that and you're dragging your bow through that, I did find that site in particular, it would drag. So there were times through that hunt in the previous days, I would look at my bow sight and it would be, you know, adjusted either up or down depending on the way I dragged that thing through the brush. So it hadn't held my zero, if you will. I think that could have been potentially an issue. I don't remember looking at my sight. I was shooting a 5-pin slider sight when I shot. So I basically pin gapped it between 50 and 60. Being that he was at 55 yards, I think that may have been an issue. But those are lessons that I'm learning. One, you should always look at your sight. If you shoot a single pin sight or even a multi-pin sight, you should look at it just to make sure that it's zeroed out before you actually take a shot. I think that's one little check that doesn't take any time at all, just to verify that you're, you know, where you want to be. Also shooting in the rain. We haven't had any rain here where I live in Cedar City, hardly at all. But next time we get a real downpour, I think it's going to be, on my priority list to, you know, go out and shoot some arrows and monitor it just to see how many inches of drop I might get at a variety of ranges, depending on rain. It's just a loophole that I need to close up. So that's a little lesson learned from that hunt. And again, that one really, really sucked. Just stinks. Late season archery elk hunts in Arizona. So I'm getting ready to leave. Already noted that. But the first tag that I ate was in a good unit. It was on a down year in terms of waterfall, rain, moisture. Antler growth wasn't great. I'd hunted that unit previously and I was seeing some really good bulls. This hunt, I was just not seeing many good bulls. I was seeing bulls, but I just wasn't seeing mature bulls. Even the mature bulls that I would see based on body size just didn't look like they had, you know, the antler growth that I was hoping for. I had the full 10 days to hunt, so I wasn't really super pressed to try to, you know, put a stock on a smaller bull. And my goal for that was a bigger mature bull. So it took me many days, probably 6 days, I want to say, to actually find a bull that I was excited about. And I did end up finding a nice bull that I thought was probably 330, 340. He was all alone. He was in a really thick pocket of shrubs and trees. If you've ever seen that country, it's so thick. Every time I'm down there, I wonder in the back of my mind, like, I'm not sure how Arizona doesn't, a lot of that country doesn't burn every single year because it's just so thick. There's so much vegetation. There's so much ground cover. It's just really thick, nasty country. Anyways, so this bull, he was kind of tucked away in this spot. And I believe the second day that I saw him, I thought, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and make a go at him. I'm just going to get close and hope that he makes a mistake, even though that's super thick. Ended up working in and above him. He was bedded. I came in and I ended up spotting him. He was bedded, got him at 45 yards, but it's so thick, I got no shot whatsoever. Really my only hope at that point, based on I couldn't make any noise or movement because I figured he'd pick me up, was just to sit and wait and hope that he got up and fed into, you know, maybe one or two windows that were just just big enough that I might be able to thread an arrow. And he didn't. He ended up getting up and walked dead away from me. It was almost, I think I've told the story before, but you know, if a bull could, you know, get up and, you know, give you double birds and then walk away from you, that's what it felt like. It just felt like he was just like, yeah, I know you're there, but there's no chance you're going to get a shot out of me. It's just too thick. And so he basically just walked off and left me hanging. Ended up putting another stock on him in the exact same situation. Only this time he got up. I think I was about 40 yards. He got up and basically looked at me, stood there totally broadside through this wall of vegetation. It was just like, nah, I'm out of here. I'm gone. Right. And ended up peeling out and I just didn't get a shot. Ended up looking for him for another couple days, didn't end up finding him. And then, you know, finally just had to roll away from that hunt without an opportunity to even come to full draw. Lesson learned on that hunt, I think you can fall in love with an area. You can fall in love with a bull. You can fall in love with any animal, right? Like you can find this animal and just think, if I put myself close enough, you know, maybe he'll mess up and he might. But reality is they don't mess up very often, very, very rarely. Looking back where that was kind of towards the tail end of my hunt, probably should have, you know, went and looked for some other bulls, to be honest, because he just was not in an area that was conducive to getting a shot via spot and stock. He was just in the thickest, roughest stuff. I think he knew he was completely safe. I burned a lot of days, at least three, maybe four even, trying to make an opportunity happen for him at the tail end of my hunt when, you know, reality is if I'd kind of looked at it for what it was and if I'd have weighed out the likelihood of actually getting an arrow into that animal, I might have made a better decision. I might have went and, you know, covered some country that was a little bit more open, that had some more terrain that was more conducive to spot and stock and actually getting an arrow into a bull. And that's kind of playing in the back of my mind as I'm headed down there this next week. You know, Neville and I are going together. I think it'll help tremendously to be able to have a spotter and a hunter. You know, we can kind of flag each other in, kind of help each other know which direction an animal might get up and move. I think the name of the game in that hunt, if you cannot actually get an arrow into an animal from a stalkable situation, is having some help in an indication of where that animal is from you and maybe even which direction he's headed. I think it's going to help a ton. So I'm hoping to utilize some different methods to find some success over the next 10 days. And then just sometimes you just can't hunt an animal. Sometimes the animal's just in a location, it's just not huntable. I mean, I want to think that I can make it work, but sometimes you just can't. So that's something that's kind of playing in the back of my mind. Colorado over-the-counter archery elk. I went with Neville. Like I said, we already killed a bull. We ended up piling out and then with his elk, getting it to the butcher to get it processed. Went back in. If you guys have watched this film, you'll know that there was a situation where we got down into a herd of elk. We were calling back and forth to them. The main herd and what I thought was the herd bull peeled off. They kind of ditched us and went down into this ravine and we watched them go up the other side. While we were sitting there watching them go up the other side, the light was kind of fading. We probably only had about 45 minutes of shooting light. And in the meantime, we had a bull pipe off back to our left. And when it piped off, I thought, yeah, that's a spike. Like it sounded like a spike, sounded like a young bull. And I kind of dismissed it. And, you know, I looked over at Neville and I think I even remember mouthing to him, spike. I just, in my head, I'd seen the herd bull go up the other side with the cows and calves. So it didn't make sense to me that there'd be another, you know, big mature bull closer to us that was piping off. And he did sound young. So just for fun, I thought, oh, I'm going to give him some cow calls. So I gave him some cow calls. I was sitting probably 5-6 feet away from my bow because we were kind of working down through and I'd set my bow down and I just completely dismissed it. I just thought, ah, it's a spike, young bull. It's not a herd bull. And lo and behold, here comes this nice, probably 300-inch 6-point and he ends up skirting right along in the edge of the timber, anywhere from 65 yards to I think at one point he was probably like 58, something like that. Definitely within range, but at that point I was pinned down, didn't have my bow. My bow was, you know, several feet from me. And that's a grave mistake. That was a big mistake. And, you know, that was the last good opportunity that I got. We ended up having a fire that kicked off above camp on the second to last day, I want to say. And originally it was just kind of smoke, maybe a single tree, but by mid morning with the winds kicking up, it was starting to really get going. We ended up calling that fire in, and that fire was burning between us and the truck. We were in there probably 7 miles, I want to say. And there was really no telling, you know, how this fire might get going. You know, the wind was raging. It was really ripping. And I'd never been really in a situation like that. The opportunity to go out the bottom was not good. There was a bunch of private land in the bottom of that, and it was a really long ways. And then I thought, I don't know how we're actually going to get around back to the trucks if we do have to go that way. So we made the decision to bail just based on safety and concerns for actually being able to get out. By the time that we left, you know, they were already dropping water and fire retardant on that fire. And, you know, we got to watch those planes fly over and the helicopters and stuff kind of monitoring it. But, that was kind of the conclusion of that hunt. But like I said, that one taught me, you know, don't, a lot of these hunts, actually, it's so many details. It's just the small things that often dictate whether you're successful or not. It's, you know, discounting a bugle, you know, not taking it seriously. It's not closing out a stock. It's those kinds of things that end up biting you, but that one ended up biting me real good. New Mexico archery elk. So again, went with Neville. We hunted really hard for a lot of days. Our goal was to kind of get Neville a bull, get one killed, which we ultimately did. It was awesome footage, really fun hunt. Ended up calling in a herd bull that came back after we trailed him all morning long. Neville made an absolutely clinical shot on this bull about 40 yards, and he died maybe 50, 60 yards. Ended up getting it, you know, taken care of and packed out. We had, I think, I want to say maybe one, we had an evening and a morning. I'm trying to remember. We only had like a day left, but we went out, got onto a bull, and ended up getting him bugling pretty good. We ended up stopping on this old logging road. And I thought the bull was back to my left. At one point, Neville had said, like, to your left, to your left. And I was kind of just so focused and buried in on looking to my left. And then straight out in front of me, I expected this bull to walk out on this little logging road right in front of me. And I was just so focused, single track mind, that, like, I was in a hallway. It was like I wasn't even considering anything else. And then things kind of went quiet, hadn't heard anything for maybe a minute or two. And I kind of looked back over to my right, and, you know, there was a bull standing immediately off my right at probably 8 to 10 yards. And, he had come in. I don't know if it was the other bull or if it was another, you know, if it was the original bull that was bugling or if it was another bull that had just got excited and come in to check things out, just come in quiet or not. But Neville and the camera guy ended up, those guys had seen that bull, but I was just so focused on what I thought was going on. So that one just taught me to be a little bit more aware in the woods, which is hard to do when you think things are one way and then develop another way. But it's easy to get solely focused on a task at hand that you kind of lose track of everything else going on around you. So I think if I'd have been a little bit more aware, just kind of, you know, kept my ear to the ground a little bit more and just not got solely focused on one thing in the way that I thought it was, I think I might've been able to hear that other bull coming in and actually get a shot. That one could have gone another way anyway. So many of these hunting situations are like that, you know. It's everything has to go perfectly in bow hunting. I say that all the time, and I've heard a lot of other people say it too, but it really does. It does ring true for me. Like, things just have to go so right in bow hunting to actually get a shot and execute it and to get, you know, get it on the ground. It's amazing to me, actually, every year, every bow hunt I ever go on, it's amazing to me that anybody ever actually gets one, because it just feels like it has to go perfectly. Lastly, Arizona archery antelope. So I drew this tag in the random draw, which I was blown away with, because you don't ever anticipate drawing an archery antelope tag in Arizona, or any antelope tag for that matter, because the odds are just so long. It's easier to draw, you know, elk tags, maybe even a sheep tag, to be honest. If I looked at the odds, they're probably comparable to antelope tags. So when I got this permit, I was pretty excited about the potential. It wasn't in a premier unit by any means, but anytime you draw an antelope tag down there, the likelihood of being able to find a big buck is good. I went down there, and as luck or unluck would have it, the weather was just not conducive. It was really rainy, rained every day. I like hunting out of a blind. I think it's one of the best ways to kill an antelope. So that was kind of off the table, which left me spot and stock, which is fun. I didn't actually end up finding a bunch of antelope. I did finally find one buck that I thought was the best representation of that unit. I would say he was probably a mid-70s type of buck. Definitely a really pretty buck, a buck that I've been really happy to come home with. And I spot and stalked that buck. I think I was within range of that buck 3 or 4 different times and could never get to full draw. The most prominent situation being a situation where he was kind of feeding down this big draw. And there were timber, actually, that kind of edged this big draw. So I was able to utilize the timber to kind of close the distance and parallel him. And at one point, he hooked up into like a little ravine, kind of headed my direction. And so I ran up the backside of the ravine, and like I was running. I probably ended up running 1.5 miles to kind of cut the distance finally. And I snuck up over the top of this little ravine. I looked up and I could see his does working out ahead of him. They were directly in front of me, anywhere from, you know, 40 to 60 yards. I knew that he was following. And I was getting ready to get to full draw, to get a shot. I was watching the buck kind of working my way. I'd end up ranging him. I think he was 58 yards. And I had a little bit of cover behind this big dead cedar that was laid over on its side. And I was trying to communicate to my cameraman to stay still. And he ended up trying to work up a little bit behind me to get the camera angle. And I think that's ultimately what ended up kind of getting us in that situation. I didn't get to full draw. They ended up picking us off and they took off. And there's not really like a lesson there. I don't think I did anything wrong. I think I did it as well as I possibly could. It's just hard with the camera guy. And I love our camera guys. They've been really good. They've been really fun to be around. And sometimes when a hunt's really hard, they can be that little extra bit of motivation to keep you going, you know, just to keep you in the game. So not so much of a lesson there, but maybe communication, huh? So if you're hunting with a partner, I think it's probably really important to over communicate. You know, prior to that stalking situation, it probably would have been good of me to say, hey, when we get within range and we can actually see the animal, you know, you may not get the shot on film, and I'm okay with that at this stage in the game. I think we'd been hunting for a week at that point. I could have communicated to him like, hey, when we see those animals and we're within range, like absolutely do not move. Like you got to stay dead silent, dead still. But yeah, maybe over communication in those situations would have been the difference. Hard to say. Anyway, so that's kind of it. Hopefully you guys learned something there. I know that I did as I went back and relive some of these. I think the successes that you have, I think it's good to relive those. I think it's good to think about the things that went right that ultimately ended up in your success. I think it's probably as important to relive the unsuccessful, the tags that you've eaten and why. And I think if you can learn from those, you're going to be that much more successful. You're going to be less likely to make those mistakes in the future. So I think it's been a good little exercise. I think it's a good exercise for everyone to go through, you know, going into this hunt in Arizona. It's good for me to go through this. And I've got that probably 8-9 hour drive ahead of me where I'm going to relive these and think about them. It's always good when you've been on a hunt before, if you've hunted in an area, and particularly if you've eaten a tag in an area, I think it's good to relive that hunt and make note of why it didn't work out the first time and try not to make the same mistakes again. So, you know, hopefully Neville and I have some success. I'll be really excited to come back and, you know, recount that hunt. I'm hoping it's going to going to be successful for both he and I on a couple nice bulls. I think you guys are aware, I've talked about it, but my 12-year-old Owen, he's got the late rifle tag in the exact same unit. I'm really, really looking forward to that hunt. He's really excited. I know that every day for probably the last week, he'll come up to me and say, oh, only 25 days or 26 days till, you know, my elk hunt. So he's really excited and I'm really looking forward to that hunt. So hopefully I have some stories to share with you guys when I get back. So that's it for this week. I'll be back as soon as I can, but wish me luck. And I wish you guys good luck in the hunts that are still out there. If you're still out hunting that late season stuff, good luck to you. Stay safe and good luck to you.